Hi, and welcome back to Living on the Edge. I'm your host, Dave Sudia, Director of Developer Relations at Ambassador Labs. This is your podcast for all things related to Kubernetes, developer tooling, API gateway, and service mesh implementation. Let's get into it.
Buenas tardes y bienvenido a Viviendo en el Borde. Jose Carlos.
Muchas gracias.
Yeah. Mi hijo va a una escuela bilingüe, so I'm trying to learn for him to support him.
Ah, pues está súper, ¿eh?
Sí.
No esperaba este podcast para que lo hiciéramos en español.
Gracias. Yeah, I can't do the whole thing. But welcome to Living on the Edge, the podcast about cloud-native technologies. And I have with me Jose Carlos, who is from Tetrate and from the OWASP Caraza project. And we're going to be talking a lot about security and Istio and getting into all these things. So, yeah, first, Jose Carlos, if you don't mind, just give everyone an introduction to who you are and your background.
Sure. So I'm Jose Carlos Chavez. As Dave mentioned, I work at Tetrate as a software engineer. So my background is mainly that I have been in software for around 12 years. The last 7 years mainly focused on, let's say, the cloud or actually distributed systems.
Sure.
And then I worked in observability for 5 years, more or less.
Okay.
Like back in the time when observability was like the early stages, like
yeah,
all this crazy stuff that we see now were like theoretical.
There's been a lot of change in the last few years.
I mean, most of the change happened in the bills now, right?
Yeah.
But a lot of changes and a lot of new features that back in the time were like, I remember we talked a lot of sampling, and now sampling is something meaningless because of everything. So like 100% collection and all that. But yeah, anyways.
Yeah.
And then I moved into security, incidentally, actually, because I moved into a company which was security on top of observability.
Okay.
And so I joined it because of my observability background that ended up mainly working on security features. And then, yeah, I moved into the trade. So these last 3 years, I was mainly working on security.
Cool. So, yeah, I think, you know, I only just learned about the OWASP Caraza project recently. We built it into our, we used Caraza and built it into a WAF in our API gateway, Edge Stack, that was on top of emissary ingress. And it's really cool. I mean, you know, I had to learn as I was demoing it, I had to learn seclang and kind of get into the meat of it. And so I just wonder, you know, what's been your involvement in Caraza and what are the things that you think are most exciting about it?
Yeah, so as part of one of the features that we were delivering with Tetrate in our Tetrate Service Bridge product, one of them was WAF, like the Web Application Firewall. Yeah. So WAFs that were out there were mainly either proprietary WAFs like AWS WAF or Cloudflare WAF that have a different integration mechanism. What we were looking for was something that you could integrate not only at the ingress level, but also inside the network to be able to deliver the full zero trust experience. and this is how like we got involved into Caraza.
Okay.
We became contributors. Then we ended up co-leading the project.
Okay.
What we saw in Caraza was that mainly like the de facto standard for WAF, for open source WAF some years ago was Mod Security. Mod Security is in sunsetting. And then other attempts to do Mod Security like WAF,
yeah,
basically depending on different components of Mod Security or following Mod Security. And what we were looking for was something completely different, right? Something with a different focus on the cloud. Portability was important because what we're looking for is like you can roll out organization-wide policies,
okay,
in your systems. So we ended up in Caraza, which is which was kind of in a similar mindset about decoupled from mod security and started with an own heart. So we also shaped it with this zero trust and distributed system mindset. For us, from day zero, one of the most important things were performance and high throughput, because we always had this vision that you could run Crossa everywhere, not only at the ingress level. So if you were putting this WAF in the critical path, it should be super fast. And also,
so you integrated into the mesh as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, cool. Right on.
So this we got involved with. Then we started adding more features. The main goal was to port this into WebAssembly, or to land El Corazza into WebAssembly. So
okay,
we could use it as well as a WASM plugin, or as a WASM filter in Envoy, let's say. And then because of the trade has a lot of work in WebAssembly, and we also maintain a runtime, which is WASZERO. We also got also good synergy on that and ended up with a really cool project, which was Corazza Proxy WASM, that you can run in Envoy, Istio, Kong now. That was mainly how we involved in this. And this is how we ended up in Corazza. We ended up doing a really good product, or let's say a good, really good outcome. And now it's getting lots of traction.
Yeah.
Because people is looking for a WAF that can be, that is cloud first, that is open source, that is portable. And there are efforts to port Corazza into traffic. Like a month ago, it was released also Corazza for API 6.
Okay.
It's getting a lot of hype.
Yeah, it's kind of becoming the standard, which is, I have to imagine, that's just really fulfilling to have worked on something that becomes the thing that everybody uses, you know?
Yeah. Also, we just got the production flagship from OWASP, meaning that OWASP itself recommends using Corazza in production, which was also a good milestone.
So what do you think is the driver beyond just being cloud native? Like, what are the features that you think are creating the situation where everyone's like, yep, that's the one we're going to shift to and adopt? Like,
yeah, so basically the fact that you can distribute Corazza inside your network with seamless integration, not needed to modify the application code, because then you make the problem of the application developer, but saying like, okay, we will roll out Corazza in a sidecar, and then we deliver the policies we deliver like at the organization-wide level, and you don't need to do this, let's say, this inclusion on every single application. That is what for us was the most valuable, let's say, feature in when deploying this in the cloud. But also the fact that you could define this at other constructs, like not only at sidecars, but ingress, but services and all that. Now that the gateway API from Kubernetes is also raising, like, the fact that we can see that how these can match in all these new constructs is that tell us that we took the right decision. Also, as I said, the performance and the ability to deal with high concurrency was also important for us.
Yeah, because that's...
If you aim to run this on every single workload or a considerable subset of all the workloads, like, you need to guarantee performance, because otherwise it's gonna be a penalty in latency.
Yeah, no one's gonna introduce a bottleneck into their network just for the security. Yeah, so that's a familiar story to me. As you said, you know, the thing that really triggered for me is saying, and you don't need to change the app code. And so I wonder, you know, I mean, obviously this was an intentional design choice, but I wonder if that was an intentional design choice, if the people working on this coming from the observability world, right, as you did, if that influenced it, because the thing it reminds me the most of is the OpenTelemetry project, right? And so as an end user going through that journey over the last 6 years, you know, I remember just generally, I remember going like, wow, this Envoy thing is cool. I'll learn to deploy it. Oh, this is a huge pain. Like, I remember I wrote my first Envoy API implementation right as they switched to the V2. And then I just finished writing that when like Istio first came out. Right. And at one point I did this talk called "If You Can Wait 6 Months, You Should," because it was sort of like there's so much cool stuff right on the horizon that just don't, if you can hold off on implementing, just do, because there's you know, people like you are building amazing things. And so, you know, even within the last year and a half, like, you know, I remember trying to convince 4 years ago everyone to, oh, the open tracing is coming out. Wait, nope, now it's open telemetry, right? But now you have the open telemetry operator where you just annotate something and it injects open telemetry in, you know, into as many runtimes as it can, right? I think it's Node, Python, Java, and C#. But yeah, I mean, it's one of the, you know, that's been the theme over the last 5 years, right? Is like, don't make developers do this stuff, right? Is if we can, if we can take it out of app code, if we can put it in a sidecar, if we can just remove that concern. And so what my last position, I was CTO at a little nonprofit, and it like the promise was there, right? Like my developers did not have to learn any of that stuff. Cause I was like, no, we just deploy it and it does all of it. Right. You deploy the New Relic operator and it goes out there and it does its thing. And you know, yeah. So yeah, I mean, how much do you think that experience and observability influenced that design?
Yeah, so it's funny what you mentioned. So just for context, I am the original author of the Open Tracing library for PHP.
Okay.
And one of the contributors for the Go one. And then when I joined this company that I told you, doing this work and security on top of observability.
Yeah.
As part of my work, I was delivering an agent, which was based on Zipkin Go, OpenTelemetry Go. Like by that time, we had a breaking change introduced in OpenTelemetry every day. So it was kind of hard to maintain, but also one of the cool things that we were doing, because we were saying like, now that we are already in the application, now that we are already embedded into the component, why don't we also run security things like blocking, like analyzing, not only observability? And that idea was brilliant, because we said like, okay, when we deliver this instrumentation, we also be able to do blocking and like threat analysis, right? Sure. in the incoming traffic. But then with the myriad amount of things that were out there in the customer's deployment, like the crazy number of types of ways people build applications. I remember we were like ended up writing different kind of instrumentation for different ways of building an application. Like it was honestly a pain.
Because when you get into someone's code, you're essentially writing on-prem software.
Yeah, and we were like, we need to implement this because that customer that is very important, and I'm not disclosing the name, is running or building their software like this. And you cannot tell them like, oh yeah, the problem here is that you're doing this, but you shouldn't be doing this, right? You cannot correct the way people or the way customers build their software. And we ended up writing all kind of integrations to fulfill customer needs. And then when I moved into the trade, and I remember I even wrote a blog post about building common libraries for inside organizations, right? So you can have everything standardized, and then this process of plugin instrumentation, observability, security will be easier and cheaper.
Sure.
Back in the days, auto-instrumentation wasn't a thing. There was some work from Datadog inside OpenTelemetry to deliver the auto-instrumentation Java agent. But just that, right? Golang was not in the roadmap. Python was as well something at that time. So then when I moved into the trade and started working on service mesh, I was like, wow, we can do everything in the sidecar. Why are we fighting with all this crap when we can do everything in the sidecar? Of course, having sidecars has other complexities, but like the idea of rolling out everything just like this, just but adding an annotation or applying a manifest. That was brilliant. And I think ever since I worked on observability, my aim was like you could easily introduce these kind of features with zero overhead or minimum overhead.
Yeah.
Because I was always obsessed with the concept, the observer effect, right? Which means that by observing the phenomenon or the experiment, you change the outcome, right?
Yeah.
For example, it happens as well in software, right? When you introduce an observability middleware, you're basically introducing overhead or latency.
Yep.
And by that time, the numbers are not necessarily what you will or what would be without the
without that overhead.
Yeah. So I was always obsessed with that. Like, how can we roll out this without needing to change the code, and also without the need of people to always be applying these policies all the time, but we just roll them out. And that this is how there was a perfect match with what we were trying to achieve with Corazza and ProxyWASM, because we want to do exactly that, like roll out this WAF without user involvement, or not without user involvement, but without the user to go into the internals of the application. Just put it in front,
sure,
and roll out the policies.
And let it do its thing, yeah. So I think on that note, like, what are some things that you would consider best practices? I think my personal experience with any kind of security feature, and I, you know, this ranges from adding a complex WAF in front of something all the way down to just installing Helmet into your Express app, is that you immediately break a bunch of things because most people have not designed their application to be secure enough to not break when you do when you introduce a thing that actually blocks all the bad stuff. What if people were going to go implement Corazza, you know, in whatever product they use as it's being adopted into all these things, what are some of your recommendations?
So first of all, I would say like, it's important to be mindful what you're introducing. Like, there is this example where you say like, okay, I put a WAF in front of this application or inside this application, and then I roll out different kind of policies that might or might not be used. So you first need to identify what are the risks in your application.
Sure.
Is my application connecting to a database? Then I probably need to protect myself from injection. Is my application receiving let's say internal traffic or synchronous traffic? Then I probably need to inspect the HTTP request. Is my application running on PHP? Then I probably need to enable the PHP rules. So it's not just putting a blind Corazza and say like, I will put everything that because I will feel more safe or more secure, because that's not gonna work. You're only adding latency. It's important to identify the risks. And risks involve what are the possible things that could go wrong and what is the likeliness to happen, right?
Sure.
And what is the impact as well? So I would say these kind of things you should be aware of before putting any kind of security measure in front of your application. Once you have that clear, then you can start rolling out applications. But the fact that you will put in another piece or another, let's say, layer in front of your application means that different outcomes could happen that wouldn't happen in your application in vanilla, right?
Sure.
So resiliency in your network is also something that is important. There is actually this topic called cybersecurity resiliency,
okay,
which talks about how your applications will react in unknown scenarios, right?
Okay.
Because the known scenarios are kind of you already handled them. But the known scenarios, and in that sense, whenever you put security measurements in your network or in your system, you should be mindful about, okay, what are the resiliency patterns that I'm also following? Because these things could fail, and if they were failing in X number of ways, now it will fail in X multiplied by N number of ways. So
okay.
I should be prepared for that.
So what does that look like in practice? Like if I was going to go do zero security resiliency, does that mean just because this is that's a new term for me. So does that mean adding redundancies into my security system? Because that then implies adding extra latency, as you brought up, right? Like what are the practices look like if I'm trying to do that?
Right. So basically what you want is your application should be able to manage retries. First, typical resiliency patterns on networking, right? You should be able to handle retries. You should be able to handle and non-happy path status code, right? Whenever, if my application is giving me a 403 or a 503, I shouldn't crash, or I should be able to mitigate that because you don't know when the attacker is in, right? But right. You don't want to also take down all the system just because one of the core dependencies failed, because that could be my application protecting itself from an attack.
Sure.
And I don't want to turn down everything, right?
Right.
So being able to operate in degraded mode, having ways to retries, having ways to operate degraded mode once one of my dependencies and fails, having a cache in front, having a way to invalidate the cache in front as well. That's also important.
Yeah.
And also, and one of the things that are very underrated, or is probably one of the most important things, is to be able to get feedback from the monitoring, right? From the audit logs, from the logs, analyze the metrics, find anomalies or detect anomalies, look at the thresholds. Like, your application is usually trying to tell you something when they fail, and you should be able to listen to that and take measures accordingly, right? Some people just plug the WAF and don't care about whether the audit logs being produced, not analyzing the audit logs to see what is happening, right? Maybe my application is just trying to protect itself, but then it's a never-changing situation, because then I don't do anything special, and then just let it go and say I'm fine, 503. But then there are different sorts of attacks that could happen. So why don't you block that IP? Why don't you analyze what are the usages that are happening?
Yeah.
Why don't you take all these a step forward to only prevent? Because one of the things that happen in cybersecurity is that people tend to think that a good metric is, for example, number of attacks rejected or numbers of injections caught. But that's not important. I don't care. How do you measure whether that number is high or low or good or bad, right? What you care is, I have from this IP, I have this number of consistent 503 or bouncing, and then at some point it stopped. What happened?
Right.
That attacker got into the network. Like, this is the important thing. Know how many of them I rejected.
You can block 95% of them, but the other 5% took all your customer data. Yeah,
exactly. So these metrics are meaningful, I would say. And in general, monitoring is underrated in terms of security, but it's really crucial. It's fundamental.
So that's another interesting thing, connection for me, is from observability to security. Then is I think I'd love to get your take on this, is that people who come from the observability world are used to visualizing things, right? To seeing the network map, right? To seeing the graph suddenly drop. And I remember the number one security thing that has ever stuck with me was at KubeCon San Diego 2019. Ian Coldwater did a keynote, and Ian was it was all based around the Untitled Goose Game. And Ian was saying, I remember that this piece is that white hats think in checklists and black hats think in maps. And that's probably not quite a direct quote, but it was this idea that, the people who are in charge of compliance, just we install the WAF, check, right? and the reason that Ian was recommending the Untitled Goose Game was this idea that it's like you get into a place and you kind of go, where can I get from here? And you saying that just now was sort of that. It was like, why did this IP stop pinging, right? Just sort of this. And you're talking about, I saw this graph drop off. I saw, the network map change, right? The anomalistic behavior. I think there, it was just, yeah. What do you think of just this idea that like visualizing is really important to security?
Yeah, because in the end, people doing security, as of now, 2023 is people, right?
Sure.
And you need to see, to be able to see and understand what is happening. There is something I always say in real life, and I keep saying to my kid, it's like, if something works, don't change it, right? and that's true in software, but not so true because things that weren't vulnerable yesterday can be vulnerable today with you sure. doing anything. You change it anything, and the same pod wasn't vulnerable a minute ago, and is vulnerable now.
Because the thing that changed is time. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. So in that sense, you cannot take compliance as a state, right? It should be it's a life thing. It's an ongoing process. Yeah. You don't say, I'm compliant. Yeah, you can be compliant at this point of time.
Yeah.
But next second you can be you can be non-compliant anymore, right? So yeah, what you say about checklists, yeah, it's one of the, in general, security, like thinking of security as a property is not the right mindset, the mindset that works as of now, given the number of threats and the number of CVEs and the numbers of data breach, is that you should consider security as something dynamic, a process, like not I'm secure now, but like what security measures I'm taking now, what are my risks at this point of time, like what is the yeah. likeliness of this to happen. There was a time where, for example, with WAFs, what you were saying, like, yeah, I need more security, I will just buy another WAF and put it in front and forget about it because, yeah, I have the WAF, right? What could go wrong? And that's not anymore reasonable, because now you can have attacks from the inside, from the outside, right? You
yeah.
could have, you could be already compromised even though you bought a WAF, right? That's not
yeah.
going to change the fact that someone is already in your network, maybe.
Yeah.
So this is why I also got a lot... got caught with the zero trust concept, right? When you
yeah.
you don't want to have zero trust, doesn't mean like you don't trust anyone. Zero trust means that you have zero implicit trust, right? You don't
right.
trust anyone by default, and you need to you need to make the conscious decision of trusting something, and then having that in mind every time, right?
Right.
Someone was asking me the other day, like, in zero trust, how do you trust a sidecar? How do you know that the sidecar won't be vulnerable? And makes sense, right?
Yeah, sure.
The sidecar, you trust the sidecar. Basically, you ingest everything the sidecars give you. And it could be vulnerable, but you make the choice of trusting. So you keep an eye on what are the vulnerabilities on sidecar, right?
Well, because you have to trust something
decision.
At some point.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah,
exactly.
To verify a public key, you have to trust the private key.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. So, yeah, this is, I would say... explicitness is the key concept here, right? Everything you do, everything you trust should be explicit. Otherwise, you will end up in blind spots. And then that could be dangerous, of course.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think that's a take on that I hadn't heard before that I really appreciate. The other thing that was kind of connecting for me as you were saying that, so I'm not, this is now a personal opinion, I'm not particularly bullish on AI in security, because every time I've tried to implement, there was Austin, who's now at Honeycomb, did this great talk a while ago, kind of saying like the issue with this is that, you know, what AI is really good at seeing is highly repeatable patterns, right? Mm-hmm. Like you have to train it over and over again with the same thing. And I used to work for a company that did machine learning for visualization. And, you know, we had to be like, yep, that's a Pepsi can like 17,000 times, right? To get it to recognize
different
Pepsi can.
Right?
Yeah. And a security event is, well, an operations event, right? An incident, regardless of whether it's security related or not, is almost always an anomaly. And so I think, you know, the systems are kind of good at saying like, this number is an outlier, but terrible about deciding what to do about it. right? Like when, when they try to set up like sell workflows that are AI driven, I'm kind of like, I don't believe that. And yeah. And it, so anyways, it's just one of those things, what you were saying, you know, about, again, about kind of seeing those anomalies and it being a constant, like it not being a moment in time, right? You have to, or you may be compliant in this moment of time, but you always have to track it and follow it and stay up to date. Yeah, that just kind of stood out to me again as one of those things of it's like it's a very human job, security, right? Because you have to intuit to a certain extent and use your knowledge of the system to try to find those edges and where the edge cases could be. Yeah, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so there is this very interesting drawing, well, not drawing, but image about the Second World War. Second World
with the plane,
War. The planes. Yeah, that's called the survival bias.
Yeah,
because looking at the part at the patterns, yeah, which are like every bullet was a dot, right?
Yeah,
saying that okay, these are the most common targets for bullets, and then what should we do? Like the natural conclusion is I should reinforce those, right? But then it was noted by someone like, okay, we don't be reinforcing that because that means that the plane can still go.
The plane made it back with those holes.
Yeah, exactly. So they are not important. What are important is what happened with those that crashed, right?
Yeah.
And this is something like people sometimes ask like, how about the WAFs powered by machine learning versus the WAFs based on static rules like Corazza, for example. Yeah. And this is exactly the kind of thing you should be looking at because you need a lot of training for the model, right? To being able to identify an outlier and an anomaly. But sometimes you don't have that much of data. Sometimes you just have a few attempts and then you need like to consciously understand like, okay, this could be a potential attack. What happened next? What is the entire sequence? And then at some point it disappeared. Okay, it disappeared because it gave up, it disappeared because it actually got into the system and now is doing other kind of requests, or you should correlate, look at, okay, for this pod, then I will not only look at HTTP traffic, but now I will look at what are the syscalls that it's doing, because maybe it's trying to curb some other dependencies or some other pieces in the system.
If we could train the AI on a CVE, it wouldn't be a CVE.
Yeah, exactly.
We'd know what it is, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I think it's a long way. I'm not an expert nor an enthusiast or AI.
Sure. Yeah.
But I think at this point, people working in security is still relevant.
Yeah. The other thing that your moment, you know, it's your compliant at a moment in time made me think of is I still do some volunteer work for that nonprofit, and we the other day pods just stopped deploying correctly. They just wouldn't start. And I think there's this trade-off of insecurity of staying current versus pinning to a version, right? So the thing, you could say this was a good practice or a bad practice. We used Heroku build packs there, and because they're much, you know, very small team, and I made the decision early on, like, I am not going to be able to write a secure container as well as Heroku can. So, you know, when the build pack comes out, you can only run very certain commands, right? Everything is very locked down within the container. I think this is great. And so we were eliminating variables for about 4 hours and finally realized that the problem was that the node build pack had updated in some way that did not run in that cluster. It was like, I could run that container locally. We could run it in another cluster. Like there was something about our AKS cluster and that is just, yeah, we still have to isolate what actually happened. With the thing we resolved that day was we pinned to a build back version before the major release. But I think that's the other thing that, you know, as we talk about like moments in time that you're compliant versus keeping up to date with things, right? There's so much and human effort, right? There's so much human effort that goes into analyzing this, staying up to date, but sometimes the updates break things, right? You know, I mean, you were talking just before about pushing a breaking change to the OpenTelemetry Go every day, right? Yeah,
Maybe it wasn't every day. Maybe
Second
day.
Hyperbole. Every second day. Not taking you literally, but we've all been there, right? We all know what that's like. I think at the time frame you're referencing, you're trying to figure out what it was supposed to be, right? I mean, that's not unexpected. But I think the point I'm getting to is, you know, like, how do you think about or how do you deal with that churn, right? Of trying to keep up with what you have to do to be secure, right?
Yeah. I would say insecure, like, unlike in life, I like to think that less is more.
Sure.
Insecurity, less is less and more is more.
Like,
the more layers you have of protection, the better. And no matter whether they overlap, whether you believe that they are redundant, insecurity redundancy is better. So, for example, the other day I was talking about with someone and that someone was saying, like, why do I need access control, for example, if every application is in charge of verifying a yacht? So do I really need to protect myself from a HTTP request not containing a yacht? Because if no yacht, I will just deny, and right, it's not a problem. But and then I was like, but why if that yacht library has a bug and CVE is disclosed and then it exploited, right? And this is exactly what happens in security. You have different layers of protection. You have mutual TLS, you can have fine-grained access control policies, you have the WAF, then you have the actual authentication, then you have the logic which verifies, can this subject identify it, can perform this action, and all that. So in security, everything is everything adds value, right? Every other measure that you implement adds value. Of course, it can bring some other problems, right? As you mentioned, right? That you could do an upgrade and then it will turn down your application because of something in the kernel or whatever.
Yeah.
And there is also a security measure for that, right? If you think about, for example, there is this concept of lift and shift. When you have a legacy application that you don't want to touch, but you want to put it in the cloud and you want it to remain secure. So what do? Well, you put it as it is in a virtual machine and you put a WAF in front. You don't touch it. You don't need to build it anymore. Maybe you don't even know how to build it. It's just a thing that runs. So there are ways to overcome all these problems all the time, right?
Yeah.
Just different strategies. But whenever you think, this effort is not worth, it's worth. I can guarantee that. So, like,
it'll maybe save you at some point.
Maybe not the way you think it will be. Like, maybe the things weren't the way you thought. Like, they weren't as easy as, like, the promise of you just deploy this in the kernel and it will work. But it's worth. So. Of course, when you start with a decent or modern stack, everything is easier because you have standardized things with libraries, with frameworks.
Sure.
It's always worth. Like, don't give up, I would say.
Yeah.
That will be
That reminds me again just of another, you know, practical story. Is we got at the nonprofit, we had a SMS verification. And we ended up getting hit by this group that was doing some SMS scam. I still don't even fully understand it, but humans are interesting. So they were hitting us repeatedly, sending text messages to, as far as I understand, random people. There was some profit to be made in it. And if anyone wants to reach out to me when they listen to the podcast and explain it to me, I'd be great. I'd love to hear it. Anyways, so we had Cloudflare in front, the WAF, and I thought, this is great. And so, you know, we rate limited the SMS system. And so that slowed it down for about a half an hour. And then they got a botnet and started hitting us for every single request came from a new IP. And Cloudflare has no ability or had no ability at the time to do global rate limiting. They just had rate limiting for IP. And so that was, I had EdgeStack, the ambassador product, installed, but we were pretty much just using it for the emissary ingress, just for the routing capabilities, right? And that was the first time I ever turned on the rate limiting feature, because you could just turn on, we had a global rate limiter. And because again, I was like, why am I going to need two rate limiters? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
And that was the day that we needed two rate limiters. We needed one per IP address and one to just be like, nope, you can't cost us $7,000 a minute in SMS fees. So yeah, no, that's a great point.
And this is back to what I said about, I'm not saying machine learning based protection is bad or not good, yeah, or not at all. I'm just saying there's no silver bullet for this.
Totally.
Right?
Yeah.
So if I was operating this, I will have one WAF with well-known standard rules, like core rule set. And if I want to double check, I will have a machine learning WAF. And of course, make it one, the source of truth, because otherwise a lot of latency. But like, as I said, more is more. So it's worth to have, as you mentioned, like, why would you have two rate limiters? That's a really interesting take. And it's because you don't know how can you be attacked. And this is part of the cyber resiliency that I was talking before.
Yeah.
Like being prepared for, because sometimes you can fight the threat, sometimes you cannot. So what do you do? I will probably just close myself, right? And put it into the turtle house and not accept any connection, or being able to have a way to only accept internal traffic. Or there are several kind of measures you can take, but it's not it's not about what measure you are going to take. Is that, are you prepared for this?
Right. Yeah, that's a really good point. To shift a little bit, so Tetrate builds on Istio. For just little background for anyone who's not familiar with Istio, which is unlikely at this point. But Istio started as a service mesh. It's got Ingress built in as well. So where do you feel like Istio is as a project right now? And where do you think the future is going with that?
So Tetrate is a good contributor for Istio. I think in terms of organization, we're number two in okay. number of contributors.
Probably after Google.
So basically, I think now that Istio was graduated in CNCF, which kind of it wasn't part of CNCF, but every other conference about CNCF was about Istio.
Yeah.
Although Istio wasn't part of CNCF. But I think this is a good thing in terms of.
I was in a couple of the governance meetings talking about that whole situation. So yeah, it was an interesting path. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But I think like what Istio can bring now as part of CNCF is going to be like it can be more popularized. As of I think 2-3 years ago, unfortunately, Istio, while the most hype service mesh, it wasn't the most popular.
Sure.
There was Linkerd as well. But I think now it's in one ecosystem that Istio could even keep growing. At the trade, we of course are in 100% with Istio. We keep contributing. We have actually products based on Istio. We have the Trade Istio subscription, which is a FIPS compliant and FIPS verified Istio distribution that we will give you all the support you need to deploy Istio in production environments. We have the Tetrate Istio distro, which is FIPS compliant and it's 100% upstream Istio. It's okay. available on Amazon EKS. So yeah, I would say like what is coming for Istio is even more stories now that Istio is also been part of CNCF and consequently part of or go through the tax security landscape. It's there are more things coming as well. In terms of, let's say, in terms of features, there are things changing. As you know, there are the ambient mesh that is also raising. We still believe in the sidecars,
okay,
for the reasons I explained before. Like,
yeah, sure.
You need more control. You basically all our visions about security is being based on the assumption that you can leverage this. organization-wide, and not turning this into a specifics problem. So yeah, I think there are good things coming for it, and we are still investing on it for sure.
Cool. Well, anything else you'd like to share with the audience? Anything you want to plug or places people can find you?
Yeah. So basically, this on top of the work we are doing at Coraza, Coraza is getting good hype, as I mentioned, and you can come by the GitHub repository under Coraza WAF.
And I'll also say that the documentation is excellent because I had to make extensive use of it recently.
Yeah, that's good to know. For us, documentation is very important.
Yeah.
And one of the cool things about documentation, which is probably popular now, but for me it was the first, is that we generate the documentation from the code.
Cool.
Which help us to keep it in sync, right?
Yeah.
Whereas before, I remember maintaining other open source projects where you maintain the code in one place and the documentation in another place.
Yeah.
Out of sync, really easy. We're also, as you know, the trade is very into WebAssembly. Like we maintain a runtime. We are very active in the WebAssembly community. We are building this HTTP WASM, which is it's basically an API that for using a middleware in your applications that will load WebAssembly binaries.
Okay.
So basically, you will compile a middleware into WebAssembly that you can run in Istio, in Envoy. Well, not yet in Istio, but soon in Envoy.
And if it's in Envoy,
yeah. In actually native Go, in Traffic, and so on. So in Dapper as well. And this is basically one step forward proxy WASM. Because we like the proxy WASM spec is kind of suspended, I would say, or hibernating.
Sure.
And we wanted to provide something with more that first was easier to use, that was decoupled from Envoy lifecycle, because one of the things about proxy WASM is that it's coupled to Envoy lifecycle, and then it's hard to adapt these to other proxies or whatever.
Yeah.
Also, that is blazing fast because HTTP WASM has a lot of design decisions that made it faster than Envoy.
Okay.
Starting for the fact that we only have two phases. We have the request and the response. No more request header, response request body, response header, response body. And yeah, we are also working on that. It's also getting some traction. Soon it's going to land into Traffic, which is really interesting because it's mainly a community effort.
Sure.
And yeah, if you're interested, you can come by httpwasm.io.
I'm writing that down right now. I am very excited about all the WASM work because as someone who's been involved with gateways for a long time, I don't like writing in Lua. So being able to write things in whatever I know and get it in there.
That's the peak of the iceberg, right? Because writing in Lua is one thing. How do you test that?
Yeah. Yeah. No, 100%. That actually, so I actually have one last question for you, which is, and it may just be that I missed this part of the documentation, like this may exist and I just don't know about it, but what's a good way to test Coraza Seclang rules? Because I think that was like one of the biggest things I ran into was I was trying to, you know, solve this issue where I was trying to fix a thing where like my host name wasn't coming through correctly. And so I was blocking it, you know, wrong. But it was very hard. You know, it was a lot of like, I was a little bit back in the Stone Age of like, try a thing, upload it, refresh the page, you know. Yeah. Is there anything that I missed for that? Or is there anything coming?
Yeah, so this is a very good question to close because it involves some of the topics we talk about.
Okay.
So there are two things you can do. First, we have a playground. Playground.coraza.io, where you can test your your rules, given a request and a response. The interesting part about that playground is that it runs 100% in the browser.
Okay.
No server involvement, because we compile it into WebAssembly and then we load it into the the browser. And this could sound like, why you do that, right? Why is it worth? Yeah, because we don't have to maintain a server. It's totally less security work.
Indeed. Less is less, right? More is more.
Before, I remember when we started, like, how do we run the playground? Oh, there is a server in somewhere. And I was like, yeah, and who is making sure
who's going to maintain it?
We restart the container once a day. Okay. But now we run it in WebAssembly and it's safe. That's one way. I recognize the playground could be more intuitive. I myself had a fun experience this week with that. And then there is this project that I maintain, which is Corasa HTTP Bean.
Okay.
Basically, you can run it and you pass the directives and you use it. It runs already HTTP Bean server.
Okay.
And you can test your rules there as well.
Cool.
These are the two ways we test rules. And actually, CRS, which are the maintainer of core ruleset, they also use a Corasa HTTP Bean for validating the rules, for understanding the performance implications in a change of a regex and all that.
Okay.
And just one plus, if you want to test your Corasa implementation or your Corasa, your Corasa implementation, Corasa also offers an end-to-end package that we use to run against every integration to make sure that they all work consistently. We like to test things. So
I'm going to check all three of those things out now, because the way that we distribute it primarily is we have a PCI 6.6 compliant rule set that ships basically on top of the core rule set. And that's kind of the default if you just pull our default rule set down. But then, of course, you can just load in a config map, but there's a bunch of ways to like load in your own rule sets. And so I was trying to do my own overrides on top of that and got into the weeds. So yeah. I'm definitely going to go check that out now. Well, it was
awesome.
A very great pleasure speaking with you, Jose Carlos. Thank you so much for coming on. And gracias por todo. And maybe we'll give me another 3 years and we will do the whole thing in Spanish.
Yeah, thank you so much for inviting me. It was really fun to talk about these topics. And you're a great host. So, sí, sigue trabajando duro porque el español no es tan difícil. Solo tienes que aprender a hablar con gente que habla un poquito más lento, no hablar tan rápido. ¿No? Entonces ya.
Sí, más rápido. Demasiado rápido.